So I'll talk, so actually nicely, following up on our discussion this morning, I'll talk about some work I've been doing recently looking at the star formation rates of galaxies and groups and clusters, and some theoretical modeling of that, and then maybe if there's time at the end, I'll try to connect a little bit with morphology. So just a word about the data sets I'll be talking to. You're probably all familiar with the, or maybe most of you are familiar with the Yang et al. Group catalogs. What I'll be showing you is basically based on a version of that, but it basically gives consistent results. So this is from the latest Sloan data release spectroscopic catalog. And what's particularly important for what we're talking to you about today, and I'll follow this up in a moment, is that we have spectroscopically derived stellar masses and star formation rates. So we're not using color here as a proxy for what the star formation rates are. And this actually turns out to matter quite a bit. And so the basic idea is you go to the spectroscopic catalogs, you find a galaxy. Each galaxy, you assign it a preliminary halo mass based on sort of inverse abundance matching. So you sort of match the stellar mass function to the halo plus subhalo mass function. And so then every galaxy has a halo with a viewer radius and a velocity dispersion. And then so for nearby less massive galaxies, as a function of their distance, the radial separation and their line of sight redshift separation, you assign them as a probability measure as part of that group. So then you have a total stellar mass of that group. Now you redo the whole abundance matching idea, so the halo mass function to the total stellar mass function in that group, and then you just iterate that until you get convergence. And this has been tested against mock catalogs and the fairly high purity and low contamination of the order of 15. So it starts, it depends on what the satellite threshold is, but for the stellar mass range I'll be showing you today, the groups start to get pretty ratty below a few by 10 to the 12 solar masses. So that's sort of the limit of living mass at which I'll be showing any results.
That 15% is still true at
a few. Yeah, so at a few by 10 to the 15, a few by 10 to the 12, then you're pushing 20% or more, 25%. So it's not a sharp threshold, but
yeah.
But for most of the mass ranges I'll be showing you, it's of this order.
Are you going to describe those mocks in a little more detail, or is that just going to be
passed over? So I guess I could say that right now. So in terms of the mocks and the simulation end that we're going to use as the modeling, this is a dark matter-only simulation, 250 megaparsec over HBOX, 10 to the 8 solar mass resolution. If you're familiar with the Bolshoi simulation, it's fairly similar to that.
Lower force resolution.
It's 2.5 kpc. It's a different code. This is 3PM code versus ART. So, and we find halos through friends of friends, and we find subhalos through phase space friends of friends finder. Does anyone want anything more about the simulation? And then we use abundance matching to assign stellar mass to the subhalos.
Using VMAX and beta?
Using M-info. Or M-max.
M-max.
Yeah, M-max. We can talk more later. So just coming back to this issue of color. So what I'm showing you here is the distribution of G minus R color, that's the solid curve, for all galaxies minus 19 to minus 20 in R band. And then this dotted red curve here is the D4000 break distribution. So if you want to think about D4000 break, basically gives you a measure of the stellar age of the population. But since it's a narrow line spectral feature, is essentially insensitive to dust. And the feature to take note here is as I move to the right here, this is sort of the red sequence galaxies and the star forming galaxies. If I were to do a cut on D4000 and ask how many red sequence quenched galaxies I have versus a cut on G minus R color, you can see basically a factor of 2 or so difference here. And this population, and you can go back and look at what is this population, and now that we have morphologies, as I'll describe to you later, essentially all of these objects that look red but aren't actually quenched in terms of their stellar age or star formation rates are dusty spirals. They're essentially all spirals, and almost half of them are edge-on spirals. So basically, in this regime, you're really being killed by dust. And so, this is the biggest problem at low mass because the gas fractions and dust fractions are highest. It's not so much of a problem if I look at the most massive galaxies. But probably what I'll be talking to you today, it's the lowest mass galaxies that actually give you the best constraints on quenching. So you really have to be careful.
Do you have a version of that where you slice on enrichment once you do your group assignment? It'd be interesting to see if that is less of a problem at the high richness end of your high mass, basically.
So I don't have this. So this is for all galaxies. I didn't make this as a function of, but that, you're right. That would be good to show more explicitly. Okay, so that being said, what I'll show you for the rest of the talk is the star formation rates, or specifically the specific star formation rates. So again, these come from the spectral reductions, largely based on H-alpha, but using other lines, H-beta, H-delta, D4000. So what I'm showing you here, if you look at just this dotted black curve for a moment, this is the distribution of specific star formation rates for central galaxies. So if you want to think about isolated sort of field galaxies in the stellar mass range. And you can see the clear bimodality of the population. There's a peak here and a peak here. Now the colored curves show the same, so the distribution of specific star formation rates for galaxies of the same stellar mass, but as I increase halo mass. Thank you. And what you can see are two interesting trends, one of which is that as I go to galaxies at a fixed stellar mass, as I go to more massive halos, the fraction that are quenched increases significantly. But what's, I think, more interesting and more constraining in a sense is the fact that this, the location of the bimodality or the minimum of the bimodality doesn't change as I go to more massive halos. So it's not simply the case that I'm pulling galaxies and I'm capturing them here. It's that, you know, you can really see that it's the star forming, you're losing the star forming sequence and you're building up the red sequence.
So
without
been,
much happening in here.
The other day, right? Been seen in like every other regime where someone's made these kind of splits, right?
Right. And so it's telling you something very particular about the way these satellites are getting quenched.
Interesting.
So I'll come back to this, but that's an interesting thing to take note.
Sorry, maybe I was distracted. So is this at a particular redshift?
This is all at redshift 0, essentially, below redshift 0.05. So let me just back up. So for the rest of my talk, I'll be using this 10 to the minus 11 per year specific star formation rate as the demarcation between star forming galaxies and quenched galaxies. And so you can also start to ask, what are the fraction of star-forming galaxies versus quenched galaxies? So this is just showing that in a slightly different way. So here is the fraction of quenched galaxies as a function of their stellar mass, and then in various bins of the host halo mass. And again, this solid black curve shows for central galaxies. And what you can see is as I go to more and more massive halos at a fixed stellar mass, they're becoming more and more quenched. An interesting thing to take note of here, though, is that the change in the quench fraction is much strongest for the lowest mass galaxies. And if you go to very massive galaxies, there's essentially no change. You can see that more clearly on the right here, where I plot for different bins of stellar mass what the quench fraction of galaxies is as a function of halo mass. And if I look at the most massive galaxies, they don't care about their environment. And so just to be very clear, if you're going to make claims about whether or not galaxy star formation rate cares about its environment, you also have to ask the question of what stellar mass ranges am I talking about? Because the massive galaxies really don't care. They're all quenched and elliptical anyway. It's only these low mass galaxies, so you know, sort of below a few by 10 to the 10 solar masses and stars that care about their environment. So there's another metric.
Can you back up?
Yes.
When you said environment in this slide, you meant halo mass, right?
Yes. Halo mass, parentheses, environment.
Okay. I just want to emphasize that because I think that it gets, every time I have a conversation about environment with an observer, one of us gets confused.
Yes.
Because this is what I mean, and they mean something different.
Okay.
They don't mean local. Galaxy density.
So I won't. I just put this.
Right.
So.
Because there is a correlation, right?
Right. So I'll only be talking about. Well, I'll be talking about both halo mass trends and sort of location in the halo trend.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm going to try to break down what I call environment as specifically as possible.
Right.
So that's what I show here is. So again, I look at the quench fraction of satellites. But now it's as a function of their projected separation from the center of the group, or cluster, or halo, or whatever you want to call it. And you can see that there are definite radial trends. So again, they're strongest at the lowest mass satellites. So if I look in this stellar mass range, these boxes show what the quench fraction is for central galaxies. You can maybe think about it sort of at infinite separation before they've come anywhere near this halo. And then as I go into, below 10% of Vera radius, the quench fraction increases. So we're seeing a clear trend that sort of time since infall, which correlates with radius, is showing up in sort of the quench fraction part.
This is also illustration of this point that we were discussing at Kofi, that
yes,
a lot of galaxies already come in red, so they don't care about this radius.
Yeah, right. So again, if I look at the massive end, there's no trend here, but that's basically because there can be no trend. They're all red anyway.
They're already coming red.
So this is why I'll argue that if you want to get a handle on how much environment, halo mass, whatever matters, it's sort of this lower mass range that you're most sensitive to, just because they weren't quenched when they fell in the first place. So they're giving, in some sense, the most signal.
I wonder, so at the halo range, right, the 10.2, 10.6, I mean, that's right where Milky Way is. So galaxies like Milky Way, it doesn't mean that, so galaxies like Milky Way has pretty much exhausted their gas supply anyway. And so in other words, they also almost don't care.
Yeah, it's on the edge of caring.
Isn't that related to just the general shape of the, essentially, the galaxy formation efficiency as a function of halo mass? I mean, if you look at the peak, right, at the peak of that, which is at basically the Milky Way mass, if you're above that, you're already going to be quenched even if you're a central galaxy, which is basically what you're seeing here. If you're below that, then it matters.
Right. So I think demarcating that is a question of what quenching is internal or secular versus what quenching is sensitive to the halo I fall in. And so, right, so if you're above that curve, it's hard to get a handle on that. And on the right, I just show the same thing in bins of halo mass. And you can see, as I go to more massive halos, it's a higher quench fraction at a fixed stellar mass. And it shows similar radial trends at all the mass halo mass
ranges. The rightmost point is the field?
This is the field value, right? Right. So again, as I go to lower mass sort of groups, there's a trend, but it's not as strong than as if I go to the most massive clusters, as compared with the field value.
Andrew, these are all projected plots. Right?
These are projected plots. I mean, that's.
You could plot these with local density?
With local density? No. So I've only made the, halo mass and radius plots. I haven't looked at however else you want to define density.
Okay. Because local density, right, is the Dressler.
That's density on what sort of app?
What they usually do is define it to be the projected density seven galaxies with the background direction. So
right. The problem there is you're changing aperture depending on how many galaxies. So it's you have to step back and think of what that really means, because I'm in low dense regions, I'm probing environment on larger scales than in high.
True, but that's the metric, and it shows up.
No, so you could do that too.
And I think it's stronger than radius, is what I'm saying. And it also applies where you wouldn't have a radius necessarily. It seems to also apply to field, right?
So it's sort of
galaxies
two.
Galaxies tend to be in over dense regions even when they're well outside of mass halo. They're locally and locally dense regions.
But not sort of local enough to be in a group.
That what I'm saying is that there has been a debate, right, whether morphologies or trends with radius from the center of a halo or with local.
If the morph underlying trend is. You see clear trends with radius.
Into the field, okay, see trends with radius.
Yes.
But that would also be a trend in local density, because you get higher densities in the centers of halo, but the trend with local density persists out where you really don't have a well-defined halo in the data.
Okay. Yeah, so we didn't extend this. In principle, you could extend this plot out to several times the Vera radius. The one complication we kind of ran into, which maybe there's a way around it, but even outside of the Vera radius, then you pick up groups that are both centrals and satellites and lower mass groups. it just becomes a little more tricky to to disentangle what's...
What's a center?
What's a...
Every galaxy
right.
is its own center.
So we just, we gave up on that and, you know, out to Arvir and then beyond Arvir is sort of...
It's an easy statistic to compute.
Yeah, so we should, it would be useful.
Your catalog, it would be trivial.
So I think this provides reasonably strong constraints on the mechanisms and the timescales. You need to be able to reproduce these radial trends. And so that's what I'm going to try to do is with a simulation is simple models for how can we reproduce both these radial trends and actually get the distribution generally correct. So before I'm more just some basic trends from the simulation alone, this is not with the group catalogs, this is just from the simulation. So if you want to, for instance, argue that the quenching of satellites has something to do with the time they've spent as a satellite, time since they've fallen into their halo. There are two things I want to highlight. One of which is that is sensitive to what exactly you mean by fell into your halo. Do you mean just the current halo you're in, just the current cluster, or do you actually include some amount of what you might call pre-processing and lower mass groups? So for instance, here I plot the sort of time since infall, the median and the 75% quartiles. And the red curve shows the distribution as a function of halo mass you get for just falling into your current halo versus falling the first time you became a satellite, the first time you fell into any group, right? And you can see that this is essentially flat falling in as a function of halo mass. So if you think that quenching correlates with time since infall, if you only use your current halo, you'd essentially be no halo mass dependent trends. Now there could be other mechanisms that kick in at higher mass, but that's just a statement that to the extent that you think it's only time since infall, you really need to include pre-processing at some point. The other thing is if you want to try to model the evolution of satellites as they evolve to redshift zero, you actually need a decent model of what the underlying star formation rate distribution is to relatively high redshifts. So again, so if I look at all halos more massive than 10 to the 13th solar masses, here I have two bins of stellar mass. And I look at the cumulative distribution of time since infall, or if you want to think look back time, here's redshift if you prefer to think of it that way. And so this is falling into my current halo, and this is sort of first time I became a satellite, so including pre-processing. And you can see that if I actually want to know sort of that where the 50% of this distribution is, I actually need to know what the infall star formation, what the star formation rate distribution of centrals before infall at redshift a half or higher. So that's actually, you know, that complicates the picture somewhat because that means we really need to know this underlying star formation rate distribution of all galaxies, you know, between say redshifts a half and one, because that's when a lot of these satellites. Half of these satellites fell in above redshift half. So I'll just describe a little bit about what model we use to try to get at it, try to wind back the clock so that we can actually get an accurate model for what the underlying star formation rate distribution is of central galaxies before they fall in. So the first ingredient is just knowing what the quench fraction of galaxies is as a function of redshift and stellar mass. So all of these low redshift points I show here come directly from SLOW, and you can get a small redshift baseline within SLOW, and at least for the high-mass galaxies. And then pushing out to redshift 1, we use the recent results from Drori et al. From Cosmos. They have multi-band photometry. It's not spectroscopy, but you can do color cuts. And so you could try to get around this problem of dust. Of course, it's not perfect. And so now you have a model. We have a model for what simply the quench fraction of galaxies is. Now you need to add on to that what the actual star formation rates of the galaxies are. So that's shown on the right panel here. So again, the red curve is the distribution from Sloan. And then basically what we do is, based on what the quench fraction is, we just take galaxies from the red sequence and then move them on to the star forming sequence, motivated by some of the results that are coming from the deep survey, where they have sort of the distribution of star forming galaxies nailed down reasonably well, indicate that the width of this sort of star forming sequence isn't evolving significantly with redshift.
Wait, so you're not measuring the specific star formation rate for these various samples. You're inferring it.
Well, it's being so you can do it if you want to actually get sort of the normalization or the median value. You can do it two ways. You can wind back through some sort of SPS stellar population synthesis model, or you can take directly the sorts of distributions from, say, the deep survey of what the star formation rates. And I'm saying it doesn't really matter. It basically gives consistent results either one way. So this is the distribution of specific star formation rates at redshift 0,
right,
at redshift 0.3, and on and on and on.
OK, and those are inferred from the data, or they're assigned through some kind of matching?
Yeah, so the quench fractions is coming from this then. And then the sort of shifting it to higher star formation rates is coming from things like Deep 2. Or, like I said, you can use SPS. And for the purposes of this, it doesn't change significantly. Is that clear? And this is for just central galaxies. Because then you can use the simulation to subtract off what you think the satellite contribution is as you go to higher redshift. And you are helped a little bit there that as you push a redshift 1, the satellite fractions drop pretty significantly.
So when you say in agreement with Deep 2, you've already implicitly done some satellite correction?
Yeah, so you know Deep 2 includes everything.
Of course.
I mean, so. So what you have to do here is we have to subtract off what the contribution of the satellites we think are already quenched. Or you know, you need to add that to the model to compare with Deep 2. Yes?
There seems to be a fairly, 0.1 to 0.3 is a fairly sharp transition. Do you think that's? Is that coming from two different data sets? Is that where you make the jump from SDSS to Cosmos? Or?
Okay, well, like I said, so
the. It's 0.3 to 0.5, everything occurs. 0.9,
it's smooth.
It's relatively smooth.
0.1. Right, so I guess, so if you look here, right, so 0.3, we're right here. So I'm plotting 10 to 10.5, so that's, say, here. Mm-hmm.
There's a related question. So if you look at the blue point, right, which is really just 3 billion years ago. Right?
This one right here, yes.
Blue line.
Yes.
Most of the galaxies, central galaxies, are star forming. But your first plot showed that in that mass range, at redshift 0, those galaxies don't care about where they are in the cluster, so they weren't quenched. So how can you not quench galaxies that are mostly star forming when they come into the cluster? So in one of your first plots.
So I'm arguing that they are being quenched.
Right, but the radial distribution shows that they're not, because they're essentially.
Right,
the same.
So the question is, can we reproduce that in the model? And that's what I'm going to show you the model.
That's right, so the data at redshift 0 tells you that these galaxies, redshift 0.3, were already quenched.
Maybe, maybe not. Or they could just have been quenched additionally, such that you get a very flat radial distribution at redshift 0. Well, I'll come to that in a moment. Right? So this sets up the initial conditions for the star formation rates before things fall. And so now we can play around with whatever your favorite model is for then once they fall in, how do they quench? So the first thing we tried is what many people have argued for, played around with, is just a simple slow fading, if you want to call it, strangulation model. So the idea is the galaxy falls in, its hot gas component gets stripped, evaporated, and essentially you retain your cold gas reservoir, but you creep not significant amounts more of hot gas to cold gas. And so there's just a simple fading with some exponential time scale as the galaxy uses up its last bits of cold gas. And so you can parameterize it. The star formation rate at some time after infall is just what the initial star formation rate was, modulated by some exponential decline with some tau. And then you can play around with the tau is and see what sorts of star formation rate distributions you get at redshift 0. So what I've done here is, again, taking the model I just showed you, and taking the infall time distribution of the satellites from the simulation, that gives a star formation rate at redshift 0. And I simply vary tau in order to, by design, get the correct quenched fraction at the lowest mass, since I claim that those are giving you the best constraints at the end of the day. So I've only constrained the fraction of quenched galaxies. I put no information in about what their radial distribution should be. So the question is, can we reproduce the radial profile? And the answer is, at least at this low mass bin, yes, you can reproduce it impressively well. The problem is, if you apply the same tau, or the same e-folding time, to all galaxies of all stellar masses, you generically are under-predicting the quench fraction at the highest masses. But you can see, Andre, even in the model, this leads to essentially a flat distribution of quench fraction with radius.
Why is that? I mean, so these galaxies in the mass range come in non-quenched.
So
and somehow you're quenching.
So the answer is that the galaxies at small radius necessarily fell in a higher redshift.
So the reason it doesn't depend on radius because they just fade. There's no round pressure stripping.
Yes. In this model. So these objects fell in a higher redshift. So at infall, their star formation rates were higher. It was faded after it fell in, whereas the guys sort of at the Vera radius had fallen in more recently, such that at infall, their star formation rates were lower. And depending on the sort of infall time distribution at that stellar mass range, that'll determine what your slope is.
When you are making these comparisons, are you comparing the same actual quantity on the x-axis?
Yes, so we made mock catalogs on the simulation using the same algorithm in making the group catalogs. So I think
you
this
actually
is
run a group finder?
Yes, on the simulation.
Okay,
so I think this is a fair comparison. Yeah. The other interesting trend is if you look at here, I'm bearing the halo mass, and again by design, well, and matching the fractions, you can match the radial trend at low mass. But the problem is that the increase of time since infall as I push to higher masses isn't quite giving you enough quenched galaxies in clusters. So it is suggestive that maybe some other mechanism needs to be turning on if you think this is all that's happening to satellite galaxies. But even though this gives you generally okay radial distributions, there's a big problem in this model, which is that it cannot generically reproduce the bimodality. It's not surprising, because all you've done is you have star-forming galaxies, and you're fading them rather slowly with some e-folding time, and they're just slowly fading onto the red sequence.
This is only satellites?
It's only satellites. And so you generically end up with a bunch of things at sort of the Green Valley because they're fading slowly, which is in, as I argued earlier, is in strong contradiction with the data.
Can you just remind me, you put in a bimodal distribution of specific star formation rates for your centrals, right? That was
yep.
That plot that we
That was
seen.
Here.
Okay.
It is bimodal.
Okay.
And you just draw randomly from that distribution when things fall in. So I think there's real problems with just having sort of a strangulation model. It can give you the generic, you know, if all you care about is matching the radial profile, yeah, it does an okay job, but this is telling you that there's a big problem, actually, with it.
You're always starting basically at redshift 1, or are you starting further back? I only
go back as far as redshift 1. I played around with going to higher redshift, but essentially everything that falls in above redshift 1 is down here anyway, so it doesn't have any constraining power at that point. But it helps. You don't really have to model the star formation population beyond redshift about 1.
But it's fading time scale that does not depend on the gas mass fraction because you think that's sort of a universal time scale given by the gas consumption time of the stars, or?
Well, in this case, I'm just seeing how well does a single tau match across the entire stellar mass distribution. Yeah, it could very well vary. It may very well need to vary as I change.
The star scale comes from the Kenny calculation. So if you go to up all the way up to starbursts, like the extreme starbursts, galaxies of different stellar masses have uniform some scalar gas consumption. So it's just normalization of Kenny calculation, and it's about 2 billion years.
So this is arguing that these are fading somewhat faster than.
Well, I mean, there is error on this 2 million years,
right?
So this is not too far off. But the gas consumption time scale is only shorter in extreme starbursts, like an 82 and stuff like that. Then you sort of, there is a signal
so
that.
Already it alerts.
Yeah. So if you look at Kenny calculation, it's pretty much linear up to starbursts, and then it starts to sort of slope upwards. And sloping upwards means that gas consumption time scale. Kind of show there. But for all normal galaxies, normal spirals that I think most of these guys are, it's pretty uniform with some scalar because the scalar Kenny calculation essentially tells you the scalar and the scalar. Gas consumption time scale is just what it's the x-axis of the Kenny calculation divided by y-axis, right? So when you see a linear relation, normalization of this relation is just gas consumption inverse.
So let me just briefly say, let me back up. So the motivation here is what you really want then is some sort of model that essentially instantaneously. And by instantaneously, I just mean some time scale much shorter than sort of a gas consumption time scale, can move galaxies from the star forming sequence onto the red sequence. So we played around with a bunch of very simple models you could imagine. If a galaxy quenches, if it falls below some radius in the group, if it falls below some density threshold.
Can I make another
yes,
comment?
Please.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there's a, this actually, so this discussion about gas consumption, that I think it's important, maybe it will connect to the points you're gonna make, I don't know, but it's, in order to sustain this gas consumption time scale, the ISM has to be untouched, essentially, by our pressure strip. The reason is that the ISM is turbulent, and it expands a large range of densities, and star formation occurs in the molecular clouds, but large reservoir sits in H1 as well. And if you remove that reservoir, then you cannot form new molecular clouds anymore. And gas consumption times in molecular clouds is actually much shorter. And so the fact that, for example, the model suggests that the gas consumption timescale has to be 1.6 billion years, or close to 2 billion years, it means that ISM is not strict at all. Like any phase of the ISM is not strict. Because that gas consumption timescale comes about just because it takes time to form molecular clouds. So you consume stars and molecular clouds, and then you form new molecular clouds, and that takes a while. And for if ISM just left alone and rotating in disk, it takes 2 billion years to consume the gas. But if you strip reservoir of the gas and leave just molecular clouds, mm-hmm. that those will go away much more, much quicker.
It's about 10% by mass or something.
Well, Milky Way is like 20%. Mm-hmm. It depends on the gas fraction, I think.
Okay.
So, but it, you know, it's like tens of percent. So I think the reason I wanted to make this comment is because if you, for example, if data favors this gas consumption time scale, it means that stripping is not just not effective, just not touching any part of the ISM.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, so we just played around with other simple models you could imagine for. I'm just going to say if a galaxy falls above or below some threshold in radius, in the halo background density, and whatever, I'm just going to instantaneously take it from the star-forming sequence onto the red sequence, and again, see if I can reproduce the radial profiles. And I won't show you all the different models. I'll just show you the one that worked best, which, interestingly enough, is sort of a RAM pressure stripping-like model. So for every galaxy, I can just compute what the background density from the halo is, assuming that the ICM follows the density distribution of the halo, and then you have the orbital velocity from the simulation itself. And of course, you know, I wouldn't say the agreement with the radial trends is fantastic. Back up. Just again, I'm normalizing the sort of value I'm using here to just match the overall quench fraction at the lowest stellar mass. And so you can get radial. Sorry.
So then you if it's above that threshold, you just take it from that.
Yes, instantaneously from star forming sequence and quench it. So I can't as easily constrain, well, yeah. So I'm just looking at what this does to the radial profiles. And it gets the halo mass dependence, both the halo, but the stellar mass dependence and the halo mass dependence better in the sense that there's at least a stronger dependence on stellar mass and halo mass. It, you know, seems to overpredict what the halo mass dependence is. But almost every other model we've tested has very, very little halo mass dependence, which seems to, I mean, obviously the data is calling for the fact that as I move to more massive clusters, a larger fraction of the satellites are quenched. But you know, the question I think that's unclear, or the thing that's unclear, is how, down to what mass halos can RAM pressure stripping remain efficient, right? Because it's going basically as a halo density and the velocity squared, right? So if at a given R over R vir, you know, rho increases as the mass and M goes as V cubed, so V squared goes, let's say M is proportional to, sorry, V squared on R, M on R, is going something like V squared, where R is going something like M to the 1/3. So M to the 2/3 is scaling something like V squared. So M is scaling something like V cubed, right? So as you go down in halo mass, this rho v squared term plummets pretty rapidly, right? And so I think for me it's difficult to understand as I go to sort of Milky Way mass scales.
And I agree with the velocity,
yes.
Not the density.
But at a fixed r over r vir, at R200, well, actually, by definition, R200 is 200 times the background.
Exactly.
So, but
it's not quite as strong.
Right. So I guess what I was meaning to go on that is, my understanding is if you look at people who stare at ramp pressure strip galaxies and clusters, see them sort of at a range of radii. Yes. So the question is, as I go to group mass scales, can I get away with it if only I limit ramp pressure stripping to happen at the very centers of these halos?
So in Milky Way and local group in general, there is evidence that dwarf spheroidals have suffered ramp pressure stripping. Because their self-formation histories, one of the recent results from HST, the self-formation histories of dwarf spheroidals essentially look indistinguishable from dwarf regulars until 20 years ago. So they, like, if you plot a bunch of self-formation histories for dwarf regulars and dwarf spheroidals, you wouldn't be able to tell which one is which until the last 2 billion years, where you see that first row of sublimation drops to zero, and dwarf regulus continues at some level. And so that suggests that somehow they
getting stripped relatively quickly
2 billion years ago,
yeah.
And don't have it now, right? I don't know, but I think it's an empirical data point for the stripping of Milky Way.
Yeah, that's. That is interesting. So of course, it doesn't have to just be one or the other. So last, I'll just show you quickly. You can combine the two. So you can have some sort of slow fading model where you put in the sort of e-folding time by hand, and then also introduce ramp pressure stripping when it falls above some threshold. And you can play around with what the parameters you use for tau. Here I just showed you an example of tau of 2.3 billion years. And then once I've done that, again, I just match the overall quenched satellite fraction in a given stellar mass range. And just, you know, agreement is fantastic, but just to highlight that you can reproduce something like the bimodality, if not in detail, at least qualitatively, by combining these. So essentially what's happening is, whereas before you saw in terms of the model, there was a big hump at sort of minus 10 to the minus 11. What's happening here is that basically all of those guys have been in the halo long enough that they pass through some rho v squared threshold, that they all just collapse down onto the red sequence. So I think this suggests that some combination of those, you can actually get agreement with the overall distribution reasonably well. But this is still sort of tentative, so yeah.
So these kind of deterministic approaches are great in the sense that, you know, you're testing a specific trigger.
Yes.
Specific mechanism, but what about just throwing in a stochastic approach to tau, you know, and say that essentially some fraction of my galaxy will have tau of 2.3 billion years and some fraction will have a tau of 0.5. And
with no correlation with anything?
Well, no, they correlate and then
ask what correlates?
Some dependence on mass and or location in the halo I guess what I'm arguing is more or less a less model-specific approach and a more kind of generic statistical approach, stochastic approach to
no, yeah, it,
you know,
I mean,
because the history of the subject is that, you know, people have had mechanisms,
right?
And there's several of them. They have kind of competing and somewhat similar dependencies. I mean, harassment, which might trigger tidal influx to a black hole, which might then blow out the gas.
Yes.
Versus, and that could be local in a subgroup versus ramp pressure stripping, which is more global. As models typically. And, you know, all of these effects could just, you know, be competing at roughly a level.
Yeah, they all have to be.
And then, you know, you might just throw up your hands and say, well, let me just combine all those effects into some stochastic model and not worry about disentangling that right now.
Can the ramp pressure stripping part of it be described by just a different tau?
That would be tricky, though, because you'd have to say you know the tau. I mean, maybe if you took the orbit at infall and claimed you could say something, therefore, about what the highest rho v squared it will experience will be, you could do that. But the point of the ramp pressure stripping was it was instantaneous, and it may or may not correlate directly with time since infall. Or at least it won't correlate directly. So I think it depends on what you want to get out. Again, if you want just sort of an empirical characterization of what the distribution and the radius is, that's probably a good way to go. Here was just to test some very simple models to see what works in both the radio profile and the overall distribution. But yeah, that would be a good second direction for this.
So what are the radial trends for this model?
I didn't put them here just because I can show you.
It should be in between. It should be better.
Yes, it's somewhat better.
Whole page should be better.
Just in the interest of time, I didn't put them, but I can bring it up at the very end.
Because I flatten the upper curves will be flattened.
Yeah. But I just want to highlight one thing since I'm running out of time, which is trying to tie a little bit of morphology information into all of this. So as I mentioned this morning, or maybe yesterday, we additionally, into this spectroscopic sample, we've input galaxy zoom morphologies. So again, this is a citizen science thing. People went online and classified galaxies by eye and asked if it was a spiral galaxy or if it was an elliptical galaxy. And so every galaxy has a probability based on the number of votes in each camp of being a spiral or being elliptical. And so it gets a little muddy as you work on the margins of things that have about 50% vote for spirals, about 50% vote for ellipticals. What you can do is call the very clean ellipticals and the very clean spirals. And this, as other people have looked at, is actually a pretty robust metric of what is really a spiral and what is really an elliptical. And
how much of it is new information, how much is just color?
Just color. They were asked nothing about color. They were told nothing about color.
In the end, so if you just take clean ellipticals, are they all red? Clean spiral, they will build.
Yes, that's what I'm going to try to show you here in a moment. So this is just the trends with radius, as I was showing you before. But instead of asking what fraction are quenched, it's just what fraction are spiral galaxies identified by galaxies. And again, I show sort of the field values of central galaxies as these dotted curves here. And what you find is you do see, again, a trend that people have noted before generally, is that as I go to the centers of clusters, I see a lower and lower fraction of identifiably spiral galaxies. And you know, it's true as I vary halo mass as well, with probably a slightly stronger trend for the most massive halos of morphological transformation. So this is simply the story about morphology. So now the question is, what is the interplay of star formation rates and morphology? And that's the last slide I'll show you here, is this. So you can do two ways. One is you can select, you can pre-select quenched galaxies or star-forming galaxies and ask what fraction of them are spirals or ellipticals. Or you can ask a slightly different question, is pre-select based on morphology and ask what fraction are star-forming or not. So on the left panel, what I've done is I've pre-selected quenched galaxies or star-forming galaxies and asked what the spiral fraction is as a function of radius. And just for reference, the blue curve again shows what the trend is with no prior on star formation rate. And what you see is, for the star-forming galaxies, there is essentially no trend with radius. For the quenched galaxies, there may be a slight trend, but again, if you extrapolate off to central galaxies at R of infinity, I would not claim a very strong radial trend there. So the statement is that there is no additional morphology evolution at fixed star formation rate.
This, I think you will speak
something. So I select out star-forming galaxies. Only star-forming galaxies and ask what fraction of those are spirals as a function of radius. It isn't evolving as the galaxies are falling in.
But, right, so the answer is elliptical from star-forming.
So that's shown on the right here, okay? So now I can ask the inverse question, or the opposite question. If I pre-select on morphology, what fraction are star-forming or not? So again, this is the fraction of star-forming galaxies regardless of morphology. Fraction of star-forming galaxies that are elliptical, essentially none. And the fraction of star-forming galaxies that are spirals. And so yeah, that's the clean cut, right? So this is definitely spirals. And you can see a slight radial trend, at least especially if you extrapolate off to R of infinity. So I'm claiming we're seeing slight evolution for the passive fading of spiral galaxies as they fall into a cluster. But it's not particularly strong. And what I want you to compare is, if you look at just what's happening to the star formation rates of spirals, you know, out at R of infinity, it's 80-85%. And then down at R of zero, it's 60%. So you've removed about 25% of star-forming galaxies from the spiral population. But if you look at just what happens regardless of morphology, out at R of infinity, you're at about 60%. And at R of zero, you're at about 20%. So you've removed 2/3 of all star-forming galaxies regardless of morphology. So my claim is here is that while there is some evidence for star formation rate evolution within a fixed morphology, that for the vast majority of galaxies, the transformation in star formation rate has to be accompanied by a transformation in morphology.
Really? I was following you up to that last sentence, I think.
So if it was possible to transition a lot of, so basically I'm just showing that the shallowness of this curve is saying that if I just select spirals, there is some fading, but not a lot.
Right.
And with ellipticals, you know, they're all essentially quenched. And so as you see the fading and just looking at star formation, the vast majority of these guys are actually spirals becoming ellipticals. Because this is just what's happening to spirals, and this is just what's happening to ellipticals. And to account for this 2/3 loss in all star-forming galaxies.
But isn't that also an increased fraction of ellipticals coming in? I mean, you have more ellipticals inside our 0.3.
Right. So.
So isn't that?
So this, I'm arguing that the spiral galaxies are transitioning to ellipticals.
Why isn't it just no?
Why not?
Why aren't they just sitting there?
Why aren't just sitting there?
The ellipticals.
They are.
They fill. In red.
Right, but out at R of infinity.
How would the cluster?
How would the cluster?
Because there are not that many, the fraction ellipticals go down in the field. I'm having a hard time decoupling the star forming fraction from the elliptical fraction.
And do you see a similar increase in the number of red galaxies, of elliptical galaxies? If you select red, you know, clean ellipticals, do you see an increase?
In the red.
In the clean elliptical sample of the thing.
Yes, but it's noisier just because there are so very few star-forming ellipticals.
No. So don't select star-forming galaxies. Select the
ellipticals. Yes.
Clean elliptical ones.
Yes.
And do you see the number densities also being boosted by all?
You're
these
asking like a conservation of number here.
Yeah. So if these spirals are becoming ellipticals, right? Do you see the increase in the number of ellipticals?
Yes. I can plot that.
Andrew, but your conclusion is based. It seems like you're saying that the shapes of these blue and green curves are different. When I look at them, they don't look.
I'm not saying just the shapes, but the actual values, right? So if you just take the numbers, right? So this. So let's take out at R of infinity.
Well, you said green is flat, but blue is decreasing. So it seems like you're deriving your conclusion from the difference in shape.
It's not just a difference in the shape. It's also a difference in the difference in values at R of infinity and R of zero, right? You're asking how. You actually have to ask how many galaxies are transitioning.
Wait, but there's a difference in the blue line on the left-hand side.
There's a different, well, so remember, on the left-hand side, this is just what the fraction of spirals is. This blue curve is what the fraction of star-forming galaxies is.
I know.
So I'm arguing that this.
It's convolved the ones. There's got to be a fraction of the same denominator.
Within a radius spin, yes.
But
that diameter is
increasing with the radius.
It's the number of galaxies closest
to the center.
That's true.
There's less volume, right? Is this a volume or a linear
statement? But if my statement would be that's true, but if I'm just thinking of a galaxy going from R, say R at R vir, down to R at 0.05, whatever our lowest radius spin is, right? So I have some number of galaxies in this radius spin, and some number of galaxies in this radius spin, right? And so what these fractions are is just, again, this is the fraction of those galaxies which are star forming, fraction of those galaxies which are spiral. And then of these galaxies in this radius spin, which are spirals, what fraction of them are star forming?
They don't have the same denominator.
They don't.
The green and the red and the blue have a different denominator.
Yes. Sorry, that's if I said otherwise.
And the red is denominator is increasing more steeply than the other.
Yes.
No.
But is there a way to do this can you plot this without dividing anything? So just showing, the actual numbers of galaxies.
Yeah, so what I probably should overplot, so another way of overplotting this is just simply, I suppose, overplotting
that might be convinced.
This with this. And you can see if I just did that, right? This is at 0.4 here, and it goes up to 0.6 at R of infinity, right? Here. So, let's see, that's of all galaxies, so they do have the same denominator. And
but you've selected spirals that are star forming, right?
Well, no, I'm this is ignoring
you've already selected star
ignoring form. This and ignoring this. So just take the two blue curves, right? And so they basically have the same values out at R of infinity, right? And but there's a factor of two difference as I go here. So
that's saying there's more red spirals.
Right. There's more
non-star forming.
Right. But it can't just be explained by the spirals fading is what I'm arguing.
But that doesn't say that they've changed morphology, right? They're still spirals unless
no, this is that is the case. So you could ask, you could think that if most galaxies change star formation rate by retaining their morphology, that's what I'm trying to test here, right? And you know, you see maybe a quarter of all spiral galaxies lose their or go on from the star forming sequence to the red sequence. That's what this curve is saying, right? But comparing these curves is saying that there's a factor of two. Sorry, there's a factor of three reduction in star forming fraction. There's a factor of 50% reduction in the spiral fraction. Therefore, additional quenching needs to be coming from galaxies that are also moving from spiral to elliptical.
But how do you do this?
Well, that's the other good question.
But also, I mean, there are differences in
what.
So there are chemical differences for ellipticals. Alpha to iron is quite different from spiral. So I wonder.
So you're thinking of looking at chemical trends in metallicity with radius?
Yeah, plus the star formation history. I mean, ellipticals is quite different up to that moment when they transform, right? And ellipticals is different star formation history than spirals because it's very pushed to high redshift.
Right.
I love this. I call ellipticals also, I guess, zeros. Because
yes, zeros are getting lumped into ellipticals in the galaxy's zoo classification.
Maybe the spirals actually transform to as zeros, not to ellipticals, because ellipticals I think would be problematic based on chemical evolution.
So that is one drawback of the galaxy's zoo dataset is, well, drawback or it's one of the features, if you will, that S zeros generically get classified into elliptical category.
Does the blue line include both? Just spiral clean, elliptical clean, or is it spiral clean, elliptical clean, and then everything else?
Sorry, which blue curve?
The one on the right.
This is regardless of morphology.
So that includes galaxies that are not even accounted for in the green line.
Yes.
That's one.
That's your question.
I think it's not.
Yeah. Enough. Maybe there's.
Maybe if you just did that, made that blue line for your two clean samples.
Yeah.
Then it would be easier to.
This one?
Yeah.
But that is what these curves are, is the star forming of spirals and star forming of.
Oh, I thought you said regardless of morphology.
This is regardless of morphology. This is a prior
so
on.
You say that in the blue line, you only include the galaxies that are in the red or the.
Oh, yes. That would be good, yeah.
Yeah.
That would be, yes.
You don't have the.
Right, so the denominators would be the same.
Indeterminate.
No, that's
number
a good point.
Of galaxies as a function of radius that weren't classified clearly as anything.
Yeah.
Right. And then it might be easier to interpret.
Yes. But yes, it's a good question then. If you just take it at face value, it suggests that there is some level of morphological transition. I mean, so you do worry about the S0s. And unfortunately, with the Galaxy Zoo data set, it's not obvious to me how to account for those. Or if you want to take them out, if you want to think about
maybe
it that
it's
way.
It's worth stressing it by using language, the S0. Because elliptical, I mean, in general, it's not easy to turn a spiral into elliptical and produce all the properties.
Right.
Even by title, just by title effect.
Right. So if we went back and looked at the. If you look at the quenched ellipticals at small radius, could probably get some handle by eye of what's actually S0s and what's elliptical, and what's more what you call elliptical. Yeah, so that's one thing we haven't had a chance to do yet. I've just plugged these morphologies in, so.
The edge on S0s are going to look like disks.
Yeah, so that would be hard to differentiate. So there would be some contamination. I've stared at just a few of these. It's hard to say, but it's hard for anyone to say, right?
Oh, I know.
So, it's the problem with morphology is it's difficult to know what a best estimator to use is, and this seems like a generic problem. And I think galaxies, it was one way of getting at it. You could use Cirsic profiles, but they have problems. So.
There's always the option of abandoning morphology.
So there is an option, and I'm not. I'm saying within the Galaxy Zoo classification framework, this is what we see. You could argue that morphology is just inherently ill-defined.
Things are robust. Things are, and with these zoo things, you could.
So you can identify the clean ones,
yeah,
right?
Which ones
so are I think that's. Not a horrible way to look at morphology in that sense, as long as you can work with just the clean samples. If you try to work with the intermediate ones, yeah, it gets rainy, but.
Would you get similar results if you just did decomposition, bulge disk decomposition or something like that, and you had fold fraction instead of elliptical versus spiral as your morphological indicator?
Right. We haven't done that. The one thing we can do, though, I guess, just along that lines, is we can ask what the star formation rate is within the bulge or within the actual fiber,
right,
versus the star formation rate in the disk, and you can try to disentangle that. So that's one direction which I think would be interesting, and maybe give a cleaner picture of what's happening to these fading spirals. Because if they are strongly bulge-dominated,
yeah,
then they're not going to evolve. So
right.
That's one thing we're
looking at.
Yeah. So that's one thing that I'm starting to look at star formation rates independent of total and disk. So that's all I have, if there are any more questions.
So in your model that you showed that worked the best, you have a time scale and that constant. Right?
Yeah.
Did you like explore the whole range of parameter space and this was the best model, or you just, this is one that was okay?
In the plots I showed you before, these were exploring the whole parameter space, which is pretty easy because you're only varying one parameter.
So the parameter is the.
So say this C. When you try to combine both,
yeah,
it gets a little trickier. And I haven't done an optimal sort of parameter estimator here. I played around a little bit with different tau values just to see what could actually give something resembling a bimodality. But I will do a more thorough parameter space investigation. This was just to highlight that you can get something like that if you combine both quenching mechanisms.
Yeah.
What do you assume to be gas fraction? As when you compute your fraction, you can see you must assume some profile of some called gas fraction.
You mean in the galaxy itself, or for the yeah. So I'm just assuming that the ICM is tracing the dark matter density distribution.
It's universal fraction.
Yes. Which
that comes. So we will discuss it tomorrow. But I mean, as Christoph is arguing that it may be increasing, I don't think there's strong evidence for that. It's not interesting.
Right. I mean, so. And part of the question here is how baroque we want to be in the models.
How baroque?
How complex?
But it does baroque mean complex?
Yeah.
How complex?
People use it in that sense.
I mean, if you're, you know.
Is it unnecessarily complex, baroque?
Lots of little frilly things.
I mean, the point here was to try to not be a SAM, right? To try to test as simply as we could imagine, making some very simplifying assumptions about what generic types of quenching work well. And there are all sorts of details we're sweeping on the run. Again, I'm only using a single parameter as a function of stellar mass.
Right.
So it's a little unclear to me at what level of adding additional parameters I gain versus lose as far as just highlighting this.
Sensitive is sort of scaling of the trends to your value of C?
I mean, if I increase C such that essentially no galaxies fall above it, I mean, then everything plummets. So, I mean, I could show you plots of varying it, but generically, it just scales the amplitude. Of course, you sort of saturate it at small radii, and then you bring it up here. So it will change the slopes as well. It just impresses me. I mean, the slope here isn't fantastic, but it's not ridiculous that by only constraining the quenched fraction, you can reproduce the radial slopes reasonably well from a ram pressure stripping like model.
But now in this modeling, you don't actually have star formation rates. You just have sort of an on and off.
Right. So I've basically punted on that and said that I don't know in a ram pressure stripping model how to. So I simply say that this happens on some time scale sort of shorter than the simulation output spacing time scale.
And so you just take it and you put it at.
Yeah. Put it at
so
minus.
So I think the ram pressure force. I mean, there is a second thing in the so it's the ram pressure force that the disk feels is proportional to rho squared, but whether it's able to withstand that amount depends on the
surface density squared. Yeah.
Itself, right. Mm-hmm. So if implicit in this, you're saying that all galaxies are pretty much the same surface densities.
At an effective radius, which I don't think is a terrible approximation.
Yeah, that's not terrible. But when suppose that force starts to, I wonder if so. Then everything will be stripped. So it's not like it will be start stripping the whole density ISM first. I think everything will be stripped pretty much at the same time. The only thing is that what I'm not sure is a molecular flaw. So. Molecular blobs are essentially in ISM, they're like blobs floating in air by density contrast.
Yes.
So, and I think their surface density is actually so high that I wonder if they actually care about that ram pressure at all.
So you're thinking, you're just wondering if ram pressure generically can be efficient at removing the.
Well, so what I'm not sure about is so when people model ram pressure, I usually think about like diffuse disk in street.
Yeah, right.
But in reality, ISM is very non-uniform. You know, molecular clouds are hundreds of cc's, whereas our density is one. Lots of gas at 0.1. Right. So there's still there's a magnitude in density, and that's pretty much the same as like within rock and air. That's what I'm saying. Like molecular clouds are rocks floating in air, and you know ICM for them is even more tenuous. Even though they're moving through it very fast, they're like a rock floating through the air. You know, rock feels ram pressure stripping, but it's not ram pressure stripping, but ram pressure force when you throw it. But I wonder
whether or not it remains bound is just the surface density of the disk, right?
Well, because the surface density is what restores the force. The force.
So why would it act differently than a more diffuse parcel of gas in that sense?
Well, so rho v squared is a force, right?
Yes.
But the pressure that you feel depends on your area.
Yes.
So molecular clouds have very small area. That's what I'm saying.
I see. Right, so you have more, right.
So it's you have to compute force on the molecular cloud, and restoring force will be still the same. It just depends on the overall surface density. But the force on the molecular cloud may be actually quite small because the cross section is very small. But suppose if something like this happens, when you strip low density ISM, leave molecular clouds intact, then the fading will not be instant, but it will be very fast, like in tens of millions of years, probably like forever.
So within the time scale, I'm sensing.
Yeah, so I think if, regardless of what happens to molecular clouds, even if you keep...
Well, so another thing so there's this paper a few years ago, McCarthy et al, right? So they looked at ram pressure stripping in some detail in sort of idealized simulations. And the thing that struck me was their claims is that for all but the galaxies that came within, 10% of our Vir, within sort of 10% of our Vir, they were retaining 30-40% of their hot gas fractions, let alone cold gas fractions, right? It was one of their big claims.
which if I'm retaining 30% of my hot gas, it's not obvious to me my cold gas would have ever been.
In Virgo, you observe ground pressure stripping of H1 disk gas is observed in several galaxies.
Right, so, this is where I was.
If you strip the disk, the hot galaxy should be gone with it.
But this is what, I mean, is this a problem within the hydrodynamic simulations that it's not capturing efficiently enough? Or because after I read that, I became very, well, it just made me pause as to how efficient this could really be.
I think there actually will be a talk at the conference about this, or if there was supposed to be an implication. But I think the stripping happens by gauge instabilities, and that depends on turbulence. So there is argument that if you actually, if there's turbulence in the halos of these galaxies, they may be more resilient to the stripping. But
more resilient in the presence.
Yeah, because turbulence essentially acts as viscosity. And so when it's viscous, it's not as gauge unstable. Interface is not as gauge unstable. But at the same time, it's not completely clear what would drive viscosity in this turbulence. But I think overall, it's hard thing to model the pressure.
Right. Yeah, because you need, you actually want to resolve a disk, and I don't know anyone who's actually
At least to model its exact time scale, which it happens is increasing.
Right, but although empirically, the people who look in Virgo or whatever
are claiming. So,
and the other thing that strikes me is it's happening for even galaxies out near the Vita Ridis. It's not just the galaxies right in the core.
Well, except that maybe they pass through the core, and then now you're just seeing the gas being trailing.
It could be, but my understanding was if you look at the H1 tails, it's basically coming out as if these things are falling in. Right. It's not pointing towards the core. It's pointing away from the core. And which.
Well, one thing that complicates, for example, is people by Christoph Frommer, and they found that there's like a magnetic draping that happens in the galaxies. The galaxies, there's a magnetic field in their halo, so the disk, and then they come in and start to feel this pressure pressure, they build up like a strong, like a pivot, like magnetic field in front of the disk, and see signature waves from gamma ray emission in some galaxies. So, when people model our pressure stripping, nobody models that.
Right.
And that actually affects the gauge stability and lifter, basically. Magnetic draping was thought to be a stabilizing cold front in clusters, which also shows gauge stability. So essentially, you just start plowing through plasma, that's magnetized plasma, right? Some magnetic fields, and you start plowing through magnetic fields of drape around you.
Right.
And form this protective layer that's provides tension. And stabilize against gauge stability. So this kind of thing can happen, and nobody actually modeled this when they do molecular pressure stripping.
Right. So,
but here's I wanted to ask you one thing. We're starting to look at a thing that I think was underexplored in clusters.
Sorry, it's looking at what?
One thing in cluster that's underexplored, and that's metallicity distribution.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It looks like the metallicity distribution looks like the center scores of clusters, despite having a big DCG actually deficient in metals.
Yes, as compared with.
Well, you can quantify quantity called effective yield, and it tells you, whether metals that are produced by stars within a given radius. It's been used for galaxies. To argue, for example, that there are winds and dwarfs, and you check metals and dwarfs. Essentially, it's defined in such a way that if you retain, within a given, say, radius, if you retain the metals that the stars produced within that radius,
yes.
The effective yield should have the so-called mesenteric wire, just constant going.
Okay.
So if you see something below that, it means that the metals have left. So stars are there, but metals that they produce have left somewhere else.
Okay.
Are somewhere else. Not necessarily left, but they are somewhere else, not here.
Right.
So for galaxies, when people measure it, the picture is that effective yield essentially is like measured for galaxy as a whole, like within an observable disk. Mm-hmm. And it's flat for things, I forgot exactly the ones, maybe 10 to 10, 10 to 9, 10 to 10, something, 10 to 9, something, but it's flat. And it's roughly in this nucleus of day collider.
Okay.
And for smaller galaxies, it sort of starts to slow down. It's a large scalar, but it's clearly slowing down.
Okay.
And this was used to argue that these dwarf galaxies inject the metals, this gas.
Okay.
But for clusters, you can actually include the same. And it's defined, I think, defined as metallicity divided by natural wall inverse gas fraction, where gas fraction is stars. With everything you define within a certain radius. So for clusters that function radius, it is like this. Where this is like 0.3 or 5.5.
At a fixed stellar mass? Or is this in the ICM?
It's in ICM within a given radius.
So okay, so sorry, yes.
So the central cores of clusters will have a fairly sizable fraction, but are deficient in metals. So yes. The fact that you have this booming central galaxy here. So there are two possible interpretations. One is that there are winds early on where these ellipticals just eject lots of metals and they have that larger radii.
Yeah.
But I think much more mundane information is actually that the fact, you know, you bring a lot of stars.
Yes.
And the metals that produce within ISM galaxies,
yes,
halos, and then those get stripped.
Contributed.
So galaxies, stars came in, but gas on average is left behind due to temperature stripping. And so there is this disconnect between the metal and the stars produced and the size of stars.
So is there any way of plotting this profile? So this is in the ICM gas. Is there any way of plotting this for, if you could do it for the stellar component as well? Maybe that's hopeless.
Well, for stellar component, actually, so the stellar mass metallicity relation is very flat at high masses. So it's the stellar mass metallicity actually behaves sort of like this, where you plot metal metallicity function stellar mass. There is a relation for dwarfs, but then above 10 to the 10, sort of flattens and stays the same. So you can assume that all galaxies, all your cluster galaxies you care about the same metallicity.
So the reason I ask is because I know that Frank's main claims from a paper he had with, I think, Anna Pasquale some years ago from the group catalog, is that if you look at the metallicity, I don't remember what tracer they were using, but as a function of group radius for the galaxies themselves at a fixed stellar mass, that there is an upward gradient as you go to small radius.
Well, the BCG itself has
Well, ignoring the BCG for a moment, just in the satellite pocket.
There is a metallicity trend.
Yes.
If there is, it must be stellar mass trend as well. Because there's no well-defined stellar mass metallicity relation.
So this was in bins, this was in bins of stellar mass. So the provocative idea he would put forth, which I don't know, but he was saying that, he was thinking one way of getting that would be if, as I move to small radius, the galaxies are preferentially more strongly stripped of their outer stellar material. And then so all you have left is sort of the inner core.
Oh, so
And so when you're actually doing things at a fixed stellar mass, you're not really doing things at a fixed stellar infall mass. The idea being you go to small radii, you're really probing the more massive stars that have just gotten stripped so that they appear to be less massive.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe, but I think here it's actually a much simpler question.
No, but that's what I was wondering about the stellar component, because that would suggest that it is sort of the ICL.
No, but this actually is completely different. It's whatever, this is sensitive to whatever, it's not just ICL, it's whatever stars ejected as metals into their own interstellar medium. Because right now, you know, most of the metals that are produced by stars and clusters, they are not in ISM of galaxies. ISM of galaxies is very small. Clusters. Mm-hmm. So it's a tiny fraction of mass.
Right.
So most of those metals, most of the gas that they injected into these interfering cluster medium.
Okay.
So metals you see in intercluster medium is essentially, to pretty good accuracy, is whatever metals, the stars in a cluster were ever deposit it into their ISM or directly into SCO. But some star frames put it directly. But
so they should trace each other. If I would look at the stars.
Not if there is refresh stripping. So if refresh stripping does, so there could be wings, so it could be refresh stripping. But given that the shape is measured well, clusters and it's measured in several plus actually also a function of mass. So there is some for small mass clusters and some for high mass clusters. There are a few systems, but if you think about refresh stripping, what it does, it on average separates the gas from the stars because stars can come in to smaller radii due to dynamical friction or whatever. But our pressure stripping just stops the gas and mixes it at whatever radius it becomes efficient.
Right? Yeah.
And so it creates effective separation. So we were wondering, I mean, this quantitatively is pretty clear as what happened, but we were wondering whether it would be possible to actually predict the shape of this curve from refresh stripping.
But wouldn't you also have to know something about, I don't know how good the constraints are, the redshift evolution of the ICM, of the ISM that was, because things out here have been sort of the integrated ramp pressure stripping from everything that's fallen in since. Well, it's actually probably a bigger problem than smaller radius. Although you could ask the question, I mean, you could look in the simulation, I guess, and ask sort of.
It's integrated, but why would we care? I mean, most of this stripping should be occurring since redshift one, right? The clusters are more or less.
I mean,
staying the same.
Right, but is a galaxy ISM metallicity evolving?
Not very much.
I thought that was unclear.
But what do you care about for it evolve? I mean, because all you care about is what happens to the stars of the gas, what happens to the ISM on its stream. What do you care about the evolve?
So what you want to try to use this as a metric for gradient for a signature of radial dependence of ramp pressure stripping versus.
Yeah, so this thing is measured in clusters. So
right.
So the question is, what does it tell you? It tells you that metals, that the stars that you see in the core, their metals are somewhere else, not in the core. Or most of their metals are somewhere else.
Right.
And so the question is why? There are two obvious interpretations, winds and ramp pressure stripping. And maybe the shape of this profile actually tells which one is more likely.
So if
there's also, of course, there's stuff like gas density profile for these clusters and there's metallicity profile for these clusters. And we're going to look like Dyske and I, that's something we discussed a couple of weeks ago when Alex Levine was here. We're going to look at this in simulations where pressure stripping happens, all this stuff is happening, a lot of winds. So there, if you produce something like this, it's just pressure stripping. What I don't know is whether we do pressure stripping correctly. You know,
right.
We can actually just look at it.
Right. Yeah, I've been talking with him as well.
Anyway, potentially this is another way of getting.
So in other words, so I could initialize some sort of metallicity mass relation, say for a moment for simplicity it's not evolving with redshift. So for every galaxy I have a metallicity in its ICM, ISM. And I also have some gas fraction as a function of stellar mass, so I know how much ISM I can deposit. Right? So if I just take some, what I think is a reasonable threshold where ramp pressure stripping starts happening, and just deposit that ISM metallicity weighted by the gas mass that radius.
What actually you don't need to put, so you take a, so what matters is that suppose you have your emergency delta with each galaxy comes in at a particular time, so threshold one, for example, right? And you assign, you know the mass of metals.
Yes.
That carries.
Yes.
Because you know the mass of the ASM and the metallicity. So you know MZ, mass of metals.
Yes.
And then your dynamical model predicts where stars will end up, right? Because you sort of know either galaxy is disrupted, in which case I know what to do for disrupted stuff, but maybe it merges with the center, maybe it gets spread. Well, yeah, there's uncertainty, but whatever you assume about this, it'll tell you where the stars will be.
Yes. And for metals, reverse stripping, if you decide that reverse stripping becomes, you know, like in this model, yes, becomes significant, right?
Yes.
That's the radius of the metal stuff.
Yes.
So then you have this prediction for where stars end up and where metals end up. Right? And that, I think, that by itself, if you do it for enough galaxies, should give you a signature of what reverse does to that, for example, for the metals that come from these galaxies. Because all this needs is just to know where stars are. It doesn't even have to be all stars. You can count whatever galaxies you follow. Right? Suppose in reality there's 1,000 galaxies deep.
Yes.
You can follow 100 representative ones.
Oh yeah.
And they already give you a shape, because the shape that this thing doesn't depend on how many galaxies. It doesn't care about the total.
Yeah.
It just cares about the stars for which came in,
yes,
and the metals that they brought with them,
yes,
where they end up in the sun. So you can just sample representative histories. The key is what we are curious about is what is the shape of this curve that Rampersha is producing.
Right. So if you just
we even know the gas density profiles in that respect, you know, for human temperature, you know what gas density is. You don't have to assume like universal fraction or something like this. You sort of know this measure.
Right. So if you put that in and use some calibration to when round pressure should be had, either a priori or from the quench fraction, whatever.
Well, I mean, what's nice about what you discovered is that you have, you don't just have Rampersha stripping model pulled out of the path, you tune it to reproduce this, or something. That's a nice part of it.
So,
and then we have simulations that we can look at it as well and see whether this gives the same picture. That's what we'll find.
Okay, so how strongly does this deviate from my simple assumption of
universal gas fraction?
Well,
so for clusters, well, we're strong except that the gas fraction is far from universal, it's considerably lower. So it gets.
Well, but that's okay. I mean,
for the function of mass, like 100 mass.
Yes.
Except that this is within R500, so you put this within R500. So within R500, the universal is here, and gas fraction as measures is say this is one universal.
Yes.
And the typical gas fractions are 0.6%.
But this,
and there's like trend as well.
But the trend is kind of weak.
It's kind of weak, yeah.
Because I mean,
but it's there. I mean, it's weak, but it's there.
I think as long as there's not strong mass trends, it's okay, because then it's just some unknown prefactor in front of my
zero.
So it just absorbs.
Plus this is an R500, but it's very likely that as you go along to find mean probably keeps going up, right? More important is actually probably the shape of this profile.
Right.
Because it's not an anomaly. Although it's not very different from the anomaly. So the gas fraction profile in clusters, it looks like this. So it means that the gas is less concentrated in the center than black matter, but in this respect, black matter, and then it sort of flattens out. So it traces black matter in the outskirts, but in the inner regions.
Does this profile also change with the concentration of the halo? Like you have more concentrated halo?
That alone is fine.
Okay.
Although the gas fraction, the scattering profiles in your clusters, if you normalize it like this,
yes,
it's really small. So in other words, in different clusters, there's some scatter, but there's not much. There's not a huge difference.
Scatter at fixed halo mass.
Even for different halos, if you normalize it in this way,
it's not
usually
sensitive to concentration.
Right. So there's more scatter in the center, but like in the outskirts, it's very little. And if you actually measure gas fractions, so if you measure gas fractions total within a given radius, there's actually very small scatter. There's some scatter. Maybe there is some concentration dependence here, but it's not very big.
Okay, so.
And most of that scatter actually comes from the inner region, so there's very little scatter in the.
Energy.
Well, so this is
0.2 R500s, which means it's about 10% of the radius.
Yes.
So with that, most of the scatter comes from, because profiles here are scattered. But outside, they're actually very subsimilar.
It's
small scatter.
Right.
So for example, when people excise the core and compute the gas mass without the core, it becomes a little tight scatter.
So one thing I could do is ask for my given threshold, what's the distribution of R over R here at which they cross that threshold?
Yes.
And this, you know, probably for massive clusters, it's all happening at R here, but as I push down the, you know, Milky Way mass groups,
you mean zero pressures?
That is far above that, yeah.
So it starts to streak even at R here.
Well, I'm just saying that in my model, the only thing I'm being constrained by is the overall quench fraction of satellite galaxies within a narrow stellar mass band. So what I could ask is, to the extent that I do get the halo mass dependence correct, which so what is, as a function of halo mass, where do I claim they're actually experiencing the Rand pressure stripping? Because it has to be at smaller radii and less massive halos. It just has to be.
But again, for this thing, what matters is that the disconnect between the stars that end up in a certain radius and metals that end up in some other.
Right. So I'm just thinking. I'm just trying to think if any of these biases matter, and if it, well. Right. So that would actually predict. So actually, that's what I'm trying to get at.
So in other words, the data to get this, with the data that's needed. Suppose we have some sample of galaxies, right? So we represent the sample of galaxies at the wall. Clusters, what's needed is a distribution of stars at the factual radius
yes.
of those galaxies. No matter where they are now, maybe these stars could be still in galaxies, or they could be streaked, or they could be in the central galaxy, wherever. The total cumulative distribution of stars
yes.
as a factual radius.
Yes.
And total cumulative distribution of metals
for the yes. factual radius.
And it doesn't matter where the metals are. Like again, it could be in galaxies. Well, no, it has to be in ICM, but I think it's a fair assumption that all the ISM of galaxies is gone now because you just don't see the fraction of mass in interstellar medium. In normal galaxies, it's tens of percent, right? But in clusters, if you ask what is the H1 gas brand, it's tiny.
Yes,
essentially. And you want to see this H1 in the outskirts. So within R500, for example, it's a fair assumption that there's no ISM left in galaxies.
So even within, so if I do the, if I do that exercise in a very narrow satellite stellar mass range, right, assuming that the metallicity isn't changing significantly and the gas fractions aren't changing significantly, and I just ask, where do they, at a function of radius, where do they fall above my threshold for Rand pressure stripping? Do I get generically a function?
Yeah, so that's the question. That's one question. But second, of course, what would be needed for this is to capture the stellar masses, which contributes most of the stellar mass and most of the dense. So you can't just get away from one.
Well, but I'm thinking, but that's, I mean, that's a good question.
You have to probably follow all galaxy most of the stellar mass.
So, I mean, as you go to more massive, your gas fractions are dropping, but also the overall masses are increasing. So I don't know if, and I go to massive galaxies, if the absolute value of the gas is changing.
But I don't know also is how much stellar mass loss contribute and something has no meaning. Because for like ellipticals have a lot of stellar mass in them and all these stars are shedding AGB or GB winds, directly into the cluster medium. Because we know that gas doesn't have no meaning in ellipticals.
But that only affects the metallicity in the ICL, right?
That's right, but it's the stars from these as they orbit, right, you just leave metals wherever they are at the time. They just spread over the orbit with weighted by time that it takes for galaxies to be at the top.
Yes.
So I guess, so I don't know how much elliptical shedding metals this way contribute, but that's a separate question, maybe not much.
I mean, that would be straightforward to implement if you actually had an estimate.
Oh, it's very easy to estimate because the function,
can tell you what it is. The fraction of mass lost as a function of time is just like some constant one plus t to cumulative fraction, fraction mass lost by a certain time is just proportional to boundary. And I can give you parameters.
What about the normalization of that?
Well, so that's still a mass, it's a normalization. So even if you tell you, you can go with like until the stellar mass, and this function tells you what fraction of the stellar mass we can lose in the function of time.
Right.
And so you can assume that all ellipticals have some age of 10 billion or 11 billion years or something.
Fine. Right. So if I've integrated from 10 billion to today, is that's the 0.7 point or so point? If you integrate that from infinity to redshift zero, you get something
like 40%. It depends on the IMF that you assume, but to normal IMF, it's like 30-40%.
30-40%.
So okay. It's a lot. It's pretty significant.
Right. Especially if these satellites have been around for a while.
And the ellipticals have climate mechanisms. I mean, the same is almost independent, but like still maybe slopes a little bit. I mean, most massive things have do so at least.
True. So, but I guess what I was thinking is that the only way that actually, I mean, if I do just a fixed stellar mass bit, I guess I'd have to actually integrate over the entire satellite mass function. Only if different mass galaxies are really having significantly different orbits or something.
Or different shapes of the distribution. So that's what I don't know. For example, like I said, if they all give the same, then it doesn't matter, right? It's the same shape. But for example, if spirals give you one shape because most of their metal deposition comes from the ISM industry, while ellipticals are doing this by this wind loss, you could have some different shape because wind loss will just raise the orbit of the galaxy. But in any case, I mean, you have the orbit because you follow it, right?
Yes.
So if you have a prescription, you just paint your metals where the metal.
Sorry, but just so I'm clear on this, the claim is that when you're talking here, this is gas phase metal speed.
That's right, I see it.
So why is it being, and the claim is that the contribution from the AGB stars from ellipticals, it's just that they fly out, and as they do so, winds are.
Imagine AGB star that sheds its envelope.
Yes.
In elliptical, there's flying through intercrustal medium. It's either deposited in its own halo, which then gets stripped.
Yes.
Or if the halo is already stripped, it deposits directly.
Directly it does.
There's nothing else to deposit at all. It's just flying. Each individual star, as part of the galaxy, flies through intercrustal medium.
Right. So,
and we know that gas doesn't accumulate in the elliptical because it may be in the central one and where it's centered, but more than other because there's no gas. Otherwise, this just imagine that you would accumulate over Hubble time 30% of your stellar mass. It's huge, right? For ellipticals, you have gas fraction 30%, so it doesn't accumulate. Plus, you can't that stellar mass which cannot go into star formation rate either because you generate large star formation rate.
Yes.
So that gas must be disappeared.
Right. So you would, I mean, if you just, so I guess the simplest thing would be if I just integrate over the mass function of ellipticals and spirals, we can get at least some estimate of what the relative contributions.
In principle, stellar mass loss occurs in any system, it's just a function of stellar mass and the star formation history.
But your argument is that if gas-rich spirals have a appreciable ISM, they could just be deposited directly into the
ISM. Yeah, so in spirals, because, bulges may be some fraction, but it would be more at the level of analysis. So most of the stars, when they lose mass due to these AGB winds, they just deposit it into the disk, and then disk gets stripped, right?
Yeah.
So you may as well just follow that process. Whereas for ellipticals, you're not anything called the carbonyl gas, so there's nothing to strip, but they do still contribute metals in this process, and maybe it's non-negligible. I know, I have no idea what relative contribution of spirals would be in this process.
But I guess what fraction of a spiral's ISM metallicity is enhanced by AGB stars?
That cannot be too large, simply because, it's only one data point, but for Milky Way, if a large fraction of metals in Milky Way was due to processed material, you should see no deuterium because deuterium is completely destroyed in stars, and it's seen in Milky Way at some level.
Right. Well, but that's sorry. This is it could be a counteracted by fresh accretion, so that's not an issue.
Right.
It's not an argument. So I don't know, but I think it's a relatively minor fraction.
I'm just trying to imagine if you could get away with a much simpler model where you have some sort of primordial metallicity of the ISM. I guess I was thinking if the dominant contribution to the metals of a spiral were these AGB stars, then you could just integrate that contribution for all the galaxies.
It can be just because you see, there's also a direct region of this. Where AGB stars are very
right, so I just don't know off the top of my head with relative fraction.
I think relative is that the contribution of mass loss is relatively minor.
Okay.
Yeah, because they just release without metallicity of stars. So trying to enrich just by weighting AGB stars, like putting yourself up, because, I mean, where metals come from, right? Stars are just returning whatever metals they were born with.
Right.
There's some additional nucleus induced in AGBs, but it's fluid and it's like carbon and stuff like that, not water. So in terms of iron, for example, you just return, the stars are returning iron that they get from ISM when they were born. Where did that iron come from?
Right.
So it came from supernovae, but what they do essentially is they said, like, well, some of the iron was locked up beforehand in stars, and now they're returning it back. So it's sort of, when people do chemical enrichment models, they do, well, supernova injects some mass of metals, and then some fraction of that metal get locked up in stars, mm-hmm. Because stars are taking some metals with them. And then the stellar mass flow essentially returns it over time again.
Mm-hmm.
But the enrichment still primarily through supernova. So that's where the iron comes in.
Right.
And by the way, what we have in here is iron. So there's, for some elements, it's much more complicated than this.
Okay.
Because AGB stars can actually produce things like carbon.
So is this from some particular paper or?
Well, it's not published yet.
Not published.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is, but their profiles exist, so it's my rendering.
I'm just thinking if I made a very crude, like I said, if I just look at a contribution from a given stellar mass range, assuming it's all spirals depositing the ISM from round pressure stripping at a radius set by my threshold, I get some profile.
We have the accommodation.
Yeah.
So that I can check for sure.
That would just be an interesting, simple.
Yeah, and there's just separate metallicity profile and gas profile and masses of the things like the M for color symbol. And it's measured for something like 5 systems, I think, of different temperature. There's a couple of systems of low temperature, 2 kV, so they're relative 10 to 14 maybe. And there's a few that have mass of 4 10.
So the other thing is, what about mixing in the ISM itself?
Mixing is an additional constraining thing, but just the fact that you have non-flat metallicity profiles, stuff like this, tells you that they can be
that,
really
right. So that must at least be as sharp as it.
So
the intrinsic slope must be at least the sharpest.
So what I've seen people argue is that you can soften the peak. So essential galaxies are just AGB muscles on supernova F1A that keep exploding there.
Yes.
It's thought to be should be producing some pretty sharp peak here in the central 30 kiloparsecs.
Okay.
Right? And then AGN bubbles are sort of stirring the gas and just
yes.
sort of mixing it, and that may soften this profile. But I don't think so. In other words, like in this inner region, maybe there's some softening of this profile going on. But I don't think AGN can do that.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, well.
And overall mixing, we know that clusters, even after suffering major mergers, they actually didn't destroy this profile. Even more strange and constrained actually comes from the entropy profiles, which is Mark Wood and Megan Donahue. So in many of the Deluxe clusters today, which actually, I think all of the guys who use this measured are Deluxe clusters. So for them, if you plot entropy, which is defined by X-ray astrometry and normalized gamma, and sort of as a function of R to R500, it's pretty self-similar in the sense that in these units, it's like this similar. And they monitoringly decrease to fairly low entropies. And only at some like 10 kiloparsec, they show some small core there. And the levels of entropy here are so small that any sort of even minor merger, if it would be allowed for to generate a shockwave, it would propagate it, would immediately erase it. So, and in major mergers, for example, if you just are able to do simulation, like an RGD simulation of major mergers to clusters, these levels of entropy cannot survive. Like you generate like a core with much like that type of
entropy.
So the only way for these low entropy profiles to survive, like mergers, so the color mergers, or it's short for the kind of is for those things to not penetrate into the core.
To not
penetrate into the core.
Oh, yeah.
So you can think about like mergers, so if core is pressurized, for example, by steep pressure profile.
Yes.
That during the merger, most of the shocks will just go around it, essentially. And so this entropy, the fact that entropy is so stratified by itself sort of prevents mixing, because what mixing does, just makes the entropy cool here. And that's exactly what happens in many cluster simulations, which probably don't reproduce the pressure profiles correctly. And so you generate the merger, you see turbulence developing, everything is mixed in certain regions. But in real clusters, it looks like this.
Right.
Which tells you that you cannot mix entropy. So parcels of low entropy get survived, and so went into the center with some sort of stability. They didn't make any difference.
So just coming back to this plot. Sorry, it's 0.3 of R500 that it sort of saturates.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they wired by cluster, but that's what I remember. I have to look again. I see it in the file. But there's a clear signature. And for low mask systems, actually, it becomes sort of like that. It doesn't really, you don't see it to be, you don't see it ever reaching this saturation. So it increases.
Okay.
You see saturation for mask clusters.
Right, so that might be reasonable if I expect that there are galaxies, well, not getting stripped as efficiently as I go down the mass function.
Yeah. Anyway, we can talk about it some more.